Welcome to episode 6 of Alternate Realities, the podcast series where we literally talk about alternate realities, different perspectives on life. My guest today is Dr. Matthew Kiernan, an associate professor at Northumbria University at the Northern Hub for Military Veterans and Families Research. Matt has an incredible backstory of his own personal struggles that we're so privileged for him to share with us today. Apart from that, he is making great strides in the areas of research that we will be talking about today. I look forward to hearing his story, and I'm sure you're going to really enjoy this podcast. So good afternoon, Matt, and welcome to Alternate Realities. It's a real privilege to have you with us today. And I'm really excited to listen to all the research that you've got ongoing and how you came to be doing what you're doing now.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Jay.
So I know
you... From the beginning, yeah.
Well, yeah, let's start at the beginning. I know that you have a Royal Naval background. So how old were you when you actually joined the Navy, Matt?
Oh, well, I mean, I actually joined the Army first. So
okay.
I was 26 when I joined the Army. So before that, I'd been a prison hospital officer. And then, of course, before that, I did my initial nurse training, which I started when I was 18.
And so from when you joined the Army, what were you in when you joined the Army?
I trained as a general nurse in the NHS. So that's actually my background, is general nursing. That's what I did at the age of 18. I went to train. I trained in Derby, and it was very interesting times when I qualified in 1991. We can probably remember back that far, where the economy then wasn't very good, and there was a period of they didn't call it austerity then, did they? It was just swathing cuts into public services. And I mean, it was unprecedented. When I qualified as a nurse, for 40 of us, there was 2 jobs. So I was very lucky initially.
I remember it well, Matt. I moved to London in 1991 in the middle of that awful recession. So I remember it very well. And, I think I've spoken to you before and said that I had a job working as a counsellor with bereavement care in the NHS. And back then, for a specialised job like that, there were 100 applicants. So, yeah. You know, totally with you on how difficult it was to get work. So you became a nurse, you got that job. And where did you go from there?
Well, as I say, I mean, when I qualified, I stayed in the NHS for about a year. But of course, the other thing then was that, as a young man with a family, it wasn't very well paid. So I answered a call from the Home Office. The Home Office were looking for qualified nurses to work in the prisons as prison hospital officers. So you were trained prison wardens. You went and trained as a prison warden, but then, you know, after 6 months, you took up a hospital role. So you worked in the prison hospitals and the healthcare systems. So I actually went away and did that for just about 5 years. I worked in 2 high security prisons doing that, Leicester and Birmingham, Winton Green. And after about 4 years, I'd learned a few things. I'd learned that it wasn't a job that you did for too long. It's a very high stress job, and I think in the long term it could actually have quite an impact on your view on the world. But I also learned a lot about mental health, because I was there as a general nurse. I was there in the general role, but of course most of my work ended up being mental health work, because you'll probably also remember back that was also the time of the introduction in the Care in the Community Act. Which had an enormous impact on society, and I think at the time quite a poor one for those with long-term mental health problems when they were moved into the community, because a lot ended up in the prisons.
Definitely.
So I think, you know, I by the time I'd sort of done it for about 4 years, I'd decided that, you know, well, this is not something I want to do for the rest of my life. I'd always been a sea cadet, as I grew up. So I'd always had quite strong links with the services because I did that from the age of sort of 11. Because I'll be joining the nurses servicing. So it's either going to be the Queen Alexandra's Royal Army Nursing Corps or the Queen Alexandra's Royal Naval Nursing Service. Now, when I looked at the time, the Quorns were going through quite a period of change in the sense that they still weren't actually mainstream part of the Navy. So they didn't have naval ranks. They, you know, they had nursing superintendents. They had quite a different rank system. I was in sort of two things, and I went to the recruiting office anyway to actually inquire about this, so for a commission, to commission into the to one of the nursing services. And I actually ended up meeting a gentleman called Paul Burnett, who was the regional nursing recruitment officer for the Quorns, who was just a really charismatic, funny guy. And of course, that's always the case at a recruiting office, isn't it? You meet somebody that you really hit it off.
Yeah.
And actually, yeah. Paul and I have become lifelong friends right from that moment where he recruited me into the QARENC. So I originally did that. So I went in 1996. I joined the QINC. I was one of the early ones that eventually, you know, after the closure of the QA training centre, we went through Keogh Barracks and then off to Sandhurst for a 4-week. I think they call it the Vickers and Tarts course, where we go with the nurses and the doctors and the lawyers and the priests. So that was the collection. I'd have to say it was a bit of a culture shock, lying in the mud and in trenches and running around training areas and stuff. But it was thoroughly enjoyable, I think, for the duration that we did that. And then by the December of that year, I'd started at the Royal Hospital Hassler. So that was my first posting. That was when it was a big core hospital for the whole of the United Kingdom for the services. And I mean, it was a tremendous place then, because that's when Hassler was probably at its absolute zenith. You know, it had got all three services working there, really good care. And we'd already, I think, started, you know, at the end of the Cold War to start getting involved in Bosnia. And we were starting to have people coming out of there, casualties coming out of there. And it was really quite an interesting time. And so I progressed through there. I did have a very fleeting romantic idea of going to 23 Parachute Field Ambulance and doing my P company. But I think second week of pre-para training, I managed to break my leg in four places. So that put an end to that idea.
Ouch.
I think I was probably a bit too big, I think, in the sense that I was, I'm 6'3" and 100 odd kilograms. And so I decided it wasn't. So it's really in the recovery of that. And I'm thinking, well, you know, do I want to work on a ward? And I think you'll probably understand when we talk about, independent practice and, you know, wanting to expand your scope of practice as a clinician, as a nurse. And it's then I started, when I had the experience of doing the mental health work in the prisons, and some of that I learned about how not to do it. And I actually wanted to learn more about how to do it properly and be involved in that. And I suppose I got speaking to colleagues within the military that worked as community psychiatric nurses, which were to become community mental health nurses, you know, both on deployment, so in Bosnia they were working at that time, but also how they worked in the UK and this autonomous practice. This really appealed to me about developing that. So I applied and, for some training, and I was selected to go and convert. So prior to that, I went out to Bosnia. I went and did a nearly 8-month tour in Bosnia as a liaison officer, as a medical liaison officer. So where we were based in Bosnia at the time, I was the interface between our multinational division there and the Bosnian Serb government, with bringing helping do that post-Dayton agreement transition. And then I came back and I went out to Sheffield University to do my degree. So what was I then? I was in my early 30s. So that's a real landmark for me, because I didn't have the most stellar school career. me and school didn't get on. In later life, I found that I was profoundly dyslexic, and actually, so I always knew I wasn't stupid at school. But if you treat it as if you're stupid for long enough, you start behaving like you're stupid and misbehaving.
That is so true, and it makes such a big difference. And that diagnosis, if it's not there, you can be just sat there with the frustration of having the intelligence, but not know what to do with it.
Yeah, you know, and that was really, that summed up my my schooling career. So I went out, and so when I trained as a nurse, you see, it was before the days of nursing in universities. It was the old fashioned, you know, you went to work for the health authority, you were a paid member of staff as a student nurse, and it was a vocational training. And so you came out with a certificate. I mean, in the middle of the 90s, I did do a diploma just to top that up. And then, say, 2000, I applied and I was accepted on a Bachelor in Medical Science for registered nurse mental health, which I did at Sheffield University. And because it was such a different learning style to school, where you're kind of, I'm always better if you leave me to get on with it, and I'll work it out for myself, and if I need any help, I'll ask. And I really sort of thrived on that, and, you know, well, cut a long story short, I went through that that course and I came out with a first, and I thought, hang about, I'm not too bad at this.
So so you really started to get your kind of stride then with actually learning in your own way.
Well, yes, and I think that came through because then I was, you know, one of the people I met on that, you know, actually one of my tutors said, well, Matt, have you thought about, you know, coming back and doing a PhD? And I said, you know, I said, I haven't got a master's. I said, well, we have this MPhil PhD program. So you start on an MPhil and then you do an upgrade via after about a year. And if, you know, if you find you skip the master's and you just crack on and do your PhD. And of course, you know, because you had a first, it gives you automatic enrollment on that if you want to do it. And I suppose through that, so I spoke to the army advisors at the time and said, you know, I'd like to do this, actually, this would be quite good. And it kind of fitted with policy at the time where they wanted to develop nursing academics within the military, which had always been quite a struggle. And so I started at Sheffield originally with a lady called Dr. Julie Repper as my my supervisor. Now, of course, you looked up the name Dr. Julie Repper. She's a widely published and known for her work within the field of mental health, and especially with co-production of care and peer-led services with mental health. And Julie and I, you know, a supervisor, but we actually hit it off as well. She's really, you know, she's become a good lifelong friend. I mean, talking to her last week for advice. Actually, I still go back to her for advice all the time. She moved to Nottingham, so I moved with her. So I actually ended up doing my PhD at Nottingham University, which is one of the old red brick medical schools, as you know. And for that, I was actually looking at infantry. I was looking at the infantry recruiting process, and that study looked at why infantry recruits failed, because at that time, 35%+ of all recruits that went into infantry training centre were failing. You know, and of course, that was quite a significant attritional loss. So it broadened my horizons. I did that really rare thing. So if you looked at all the literature at the time, it was sort of all studying why these recruits failed. But of course, what I did, I flipped it on its head and said, well, what part did the institution play in their failure?
Excellent.
So how can they actually make it?
You
know?
Excellent.
So of course, this is something, you know, and I think that very early, I mean, because that's, you know, I'm not going to take credit for that, because that's really Julie, you know, as my supervisor, saying, well, you know, you've done your literature review here, you've looked at all this, and every paper is the individual's fault why they failed, but surely the institution has to bear some responsibility for the, you know, for the rate of failure. And that's a lesson I think I learned, which I sort of taken through to the research centre now, that when you start to look at these problems, you've got to step back.
Yeah.
And look at the different angles and directions you can look at a problem from, and actually bring in advisors, bring in other people. So, you know, because if you're not careful, you never see the wood for the trees, I think the old saying goes.
That's very true, isn't it? When you take a step back and you're looking at the whole picture, then you're seeing all the components rather than just, you know, one or two parts of it.
Yeah, so it was really at sort of that time in 2003-04, there was an enormous change underwent in defence mental health services. So up until 2004, it was the defence mental health services. It was a tri-service organisation. We had the hospital unit at Catterick, which was a specialised military inpatient unit for the whole of the UK. And tri-service nurses went there. So we had all different uniforms working there with civilians. And then you had the departments of community mental health across the country. One way and another, the Brown report was undertaken, and it was decided that it was much better to close that hospital and have regional beds in either private hospitals or NHS hospitals for those service personnel that needed hospitalisation, and go to a very much a community-based model. And that brought about the dissolving of the Tri-Service Directorate of Defence Psychiatry. And the problem the Navy had was that they had no nursing officers. They actually had no naval nursing officers, mental health officers. They were just about to promote a few of their senior rates to try and fill that gap, but they had no experienced officers. So, I mean, at that time I was asked if, would you consider, because I was OC of the hospital at that time. So the inpatient unit at Catterick, I was the nurse in charge, the senior nursing officer who ran that unit up at Catterick, the UK-wide inpatient unit. And having a Sea Cadet background, I kind of jumped at the chance and said, yeah, I'd love to. And they made me an offer I couldn't refuse, because I came across and I held my rank and, within time they offered me full career service. So I transferred across as the head of Naval Mental Health Nursing back in 2004. And really that's where I stayed in that service till 2010, and developing the Naval Mental Health Services along with my, my boss for the next 6 years, but also became another lifelong friend, Surgeon Captain John Sharpley. We got on very well, and we embarked on a period of modernization of the mental health services. And that was quite important that we did that tri-service, because at that time, as now when we're looking at the dates, we'd done Bosnia, we'd done Kosovo, we were really starting to just build up, and then by 2003 getting involved in Iraq again. There was the background stuff going on in Afghanistan, and things were really starting to ramp up, and we needed to have mental health nurses that were fit, able, and clinically capable to serve on the ground in these theatres of conflict. We needed those services out there. So, along with myself and the likes of Colonel Rod Eldridge for the Army and Squadron Leader Ben Campion in the Air Force, we had to very quickly look at the mental health services, the nurses, because it was always the nurses that deployed. So the nurses would deploy. You'd always have three or four nurses in any one area, but they'd be working as lone practitioners. So they'd be working on their own. You'd be in contact with each other, but very rarely in the same destination. And so it became a very, very busy period. And of course we deployed. So I mean, my 5-year PhD part-time took 10 years because they kept sending me away to war every wow. other year. So of course you had to keep stopping your study and then starting it again. And so I deployed into Iraq. I've done Bosnia, Kosovo, Iraq, and Afghanistan.
But that's a massive achievement, Matt. Even if it did take so much longer, because it's for anybody a PhD is a heavy workload, and to do that while you were doing the job you were doing, I mean, all credit to you. That's incredible.
But I must admit, when I have my PhD students at the university, I said, well, just to bring you from perspective, I said, me like many of those that do their PhDs whilst they're in practice. I said, I was the head of mental health nursing in the Navy. I was defence specialist nurse advisor for mental health. And as you said, we kept getting sent, sent away to war. Every time you just got your head back in your studies, you would be redeployed again. But, you work through it. I always say to my students, a PhD is a marathon, not a sprint. And actually, a lot of the people, it's about your ability to keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if you're getting a thing where you're constantly getting interrupted, and you know you've got to be deployed, and then you're trying to get back to it, and it's kind of like on and off, basically, isn't it? So it is that thing that just keep your eye on the goal and then keep going.
Yeah, and it did. I mean, I sort of pushed through there, but I think 2009 I did my last tour. Yeah, which was in Afghanistan, and unfortunately, on that tour, I contracted multiple organ atypical tuberculosis. So it's the best way to describe it is it's TB's nasty, horrible distant cousin. So it's a disease called Mycobacterium abscessus. They believe it went in my lungs originally. Because I did fall very ill when I was out there with a very nasty lung infection. But at the same time, there was pneumococcal pneumonia going around a lot of the troops. So it was just assumed that it was the same. And so we're given a 2-week course of antibiotics. And then I felt not too bad again. But of course, within sort of 9 months of coming back, I'd fallen critically ill. And ultimately, over the next 3 years, I mean, I didn't work for those 3 years. I was in and out of hospital. I had, I think by that in that period alone, about 10 to 12 operations. And I was had a Hickman line in my neck for 18 months with the treatment to try and get on top of the illness. And the illness left me with catastrophic injuries to my lower abdomen and my pelvis, where a lot of the infection had set in. Because unfortunately, it's very common, it sets into your waterworks, and that's where it, because it goes through the lymphatic system and then gets into your kidneys and bladder. So that made me very ill, and it caused a lot of difficulties. I mean, of course, and by that time there was, as they quite humorously said on my medical board, well, there's not really enough left of you to carry on serving, Matt, so we'll probably have to think about discharging you. Was my friend who was the occupational health physician, a bit tongue in cheek, but he was quite right. By that time, I had a lot of surgery and a lot of bits and bobs removed, and I'd been very, very ill. So, and I still wasn't that well really when I was leaving, and so, but I was very, very lucky because I mean I was in a bit of a blind panic, and because. I'd expected to be in the Navy till I was 55 years old, and we hadn't expected, we as a family weren't geared up to leaving then. And then my poor wife had somebody, at multiple points along this journey, she's been told, well, I don't know if he's going to survive this one. He's really, really ill. And, and he's trying to fight the infection. There's been a few of those conversations to be had. One last year when I was very critically ill. And, it was a stressful time because, I mean, all I was hell-bent on was trying to get them a house to live in. If anything happened to me, then at least they got a house to live in. But it's funny how these things sort of shine through. So one of the things was that, we had nursing colleagues that we trained with who, they were, one of them, Debbie, she was a specialist TB nurse. And she said, look, because we were in Portsmouth at the time, Debbie said, Vicky, you need to get him to Newcastle or Leeds. They are the best centres in the country for dealing with this. And, and so I was lucky the military moved us up to Catterick Garrison and where I could access the Newcastle hospitals. And that's really health-wise, I think, where I started to turn around because I came under the care of the RVI at Newcastle and the infectious diseases unit and the general surgery guys there and the urology guys there. And then from that point, I started to get better. I mean, it was tremendous. And as I was getting better, because I was worrying about work, saying, oh, I've got to work. I've got to be able to have a family. And what am I going to do? I can't go into practice. I can't continue in that. I'm not well enough. So I just speculatively went to an interview at Northumbria University with their nursing department, and I got no expectations of it. And you can imagine, I mean, I was still quite jaundiced at the time, so I was yellow in my eyes. I mean, I looked back at some of the photographs, and I looked absolutely awful. I don't know why they even considered giving me a job. I don't think
many people actually really understand that there are different types of tuberculosis, and yeah. I don't think they really understand how serious it can be. And one of the things I'd said to you was, you know, that it's something that my uncle died of at the age of 31. My father had TB, not the same type as you, but he did have half a lung removed. And my youngest daughter was diagnosed with it at the age of 3. And we were incredibly lucky that it was the abscess was in a place that was diagnosed very quickly and treatment was swift. But once it gets hold in the way that it did with you, it's such a debilitating...
See, there's TB, which is your regular mycobacterium, but as I had something called mycobacterium abscessus. So with TB, TB is quite slow-acting. It's quite insidious, but mycobacterium abscessus is really aggressive.
Yeah.
So it gets in and it spreads really quickly and it does exactly what it says on the tin. It just spreads to the body, you know, creating abscesses. We go and it eats through the different organs. And if with me, it attacked the bowel and the bladder and across.
Yeah.
But I went to this interview and, they didn't give me the job I went for, because then a lady called Margaret Rowe, who was the dean at the time, she just went, no, I don't want to give you that job, because actually I'm really interested in your research and your research ideas and what we talked about on the interview. Can you give me 2 weeks and I'll come back with you and I'd like to organise a position for you.
You went for one job, actually feeling like you got no chance of getting it because you felt so poorly, and ended up having something created.
Yeah, well, that was, you know, this was great, you know, so they created this sort of new role where they said, well, you're a senior lecturer in mental health, but actually what we want you to do is, can you start to sort of develop your ideas around this, you know? And so with colleagues, some like-minded colleagues there, we cut a long story short, we developed the Northern Hub for Veterans and Military Families Research. And I think what was quite important about that was that, as you know, the Northeast is one of the very highly populated areas in the country with veterans.
Yes.
And as soon as you start to, you know, start to talk to people, and you suddenly find that half the people you're working with have served in the military in that area. It was one way or another. So then I bump into a gentleman called Professor Glyn Howardson, you know, who actually, he was a boy soldier. He'd gone into the military. He'd come from a very disadvantaged background, but he was a fantastic rugby player, you know. So he'd served in Gulf War One, come out, and off the back of that, got an education and, you know, now a professor, you know, in sports physiology there. So suddenly we had this whole network. And I think it's really important to reflect of why we call it the hub. So we might talk, you know, about the research centre in sort of a colloquial terms, but it's not, it's a hub, because the whole design of the hub was that it was, what we did was translational research, applied research. And what I mean by that is that any research programme we did is about making a change or making a difference. So there's other research, you know, because there's these two sorts. So there's a lot of people that do the sort of the high-end theoretical side of it, and that's quite important that we have that. But it's also important that we actually have people that take evidence and work to implement into change to hopefully improve. And that's where I was always going to sit, because, you know, I think in the conversation we had before this, I mean, I'm, you know, I really enjoy what I do, but if you asked me if I was an academic, I'd say, no, not really. I said, because as soon as I finish my day's work, you'll find me in the workshop, you know, with my collection of vintage and classic motorcycles, building an engine. I think if I could get away with it and make it pay, that's probably what I'd do if I wasn't.
I think so, that's brilliant. Driven.
Yeah. You know, so yeah, but that's my, you know, so I think when we finish here, we'll have an hour in the workshop. My youngest son and I will go, and, you know, we're working on a bike at the moment. We're, you know, restoring a 40-year-old BMW motorcycle. But what drives me with this, and I think when you get to meet the team and, you know, you look at the team I work with, they all have that same passion.
Yeah.
We work in the university. Yeah. We like what we do, but we're actually driven by, we want to make change. I think for me, it was about, actually this journey was quite hard for many aspects. And I was a lieutenant commander and I was a medic and I had the knowledge. What would have happened to a young private soldier if he'd been in my position. Now, my wife's really clear about that. She said, well, he'd be dead. Absolutely, yeah. Said, because it's only because my wife is a nurse and that I have the background that when people have a condition that they don't understand and actually they haven't got it, you know, and they keep missing stuff. And, you know, I mean, I was only diagnosed when my wife insisted that they screen for tuberculosis. And it's only when they screen for tuberculosis, they said, well, you actually haven't got tuberculosis, but you've actually got mycobacterium abscessus, which creates, because it's multiple drug resistant.
Yeah.
And so it was only through her insistence that we got to that and started the right treatment and got to the right hospital. So a lot of the drive for the hub was information's got to be better. We've got to have that accessibility for information, you know, out there. And of course, that really became the whole of the map of need, which is one of our big flagship projects, multi-million pound. We've been doing it for 7 years now. We produce the database that powers the Veterans Gateway service, you know, and we built the app for them for the Veterans Gateway. We analyze all the data. You know, and this is about this whole around information, putting information in a place where it's easily accessible so those that need the help can actually access it. And not happening what happened to me on far too many occasions, people saying, yes, we can help you. And then they come and then they take 2 hours of your life doing this assessment to only then say, let me signpost you to these people over here who are just going to do the same thing again. You know, and I think that was one of the most frustrating aspects of you know, my time when at the times when there was an element that I probably wasn't going to survive and I actually wanted to make things right for the family and get things done. But people were just taking your time and wasting it when you were trying to sort of do that. It's so hard, isn't it, Matt?
Because having been at that place a couple of times in the last 7 years, you know, where I was in two situations where, you know, it was a thin line as to whether I'd make it or not. You know, when you're in that situation, you know, every single ounce of energy that you have needs to go into that illness. And when you're being distracted somewhere else, it's the last thing you need.
And it is, yeah, and it's... And it was, you know, it was difficult. But I suppose I came out the other side because once I landed at the university, it was a corner turn. But I think the other thing, so I think they were absolutely amazing to have even contemplated employing me. And of course, then the first thing I do within about 12 months is become really, really ill again and have to go and have a lot of surgery. So actually, in the 7 years I've been there, I've actually only been at work for 3.5 years of it. Because you know, I think, as I shared with you, I've been quite unwell. Because just as I was getting better from this, and I was starting to get back on my feet, and you know, I'd started into cycling in quite a big way to get my fitness back, and then 2015, I had a massive heart attack. As for whatever reason, and then. So, of course, that was back to square one, a bit rushed to hospital, had to have surgery on my heart, have some bypassing put in, and the thing that potentially, you know, some damage caused in how I was treated in the treatment, you know, because there's always the case, it's very common in cancer patients that what saves your life can cause you additional problems. And the thing in my case, what saved my life caused me additional problems. Yeah. So sort of coming round from that, and then promptly a week later had a second quite significant heart attack after the first one. So so that took a bit of time getting over. So then a year later, I thought I was over that and I was doing fine. I had a third one. So but luckily the third one wasn't structured. The third one was I just threw off a random blood clot, you know, which they couldn't understand why it had happened. So, you know, but each of these keep knocking you back. And yeah, I think it's, you know, it's health wise and trying to get going. But I think the thing I take from that is that the team that I'd built at the university around me were so good that actually many people would have probably not even seen me not there, because they just carried on and they got on, you know, because they share the same drive themselves. And a lot of them are either veterans by background or they're children of serving personnel. And we deliberately look for that. Although I have quite a multinational collection in there now. So I have a very, very clever chap, Dr. Michael Rodriguez, who's from Portugal. Because in human geography, with a lot of the analysis we do about the distribution of the population across the UK, Michael is, he was the best we could find, and he's absolutely tremendous. And then we have Dr. Anastasia Fadiva from St. Petersburg, you know, who is a medical doctor as well as an epidemiologist. And again, you know, these very, very bright people that are, you know, they're really motivated and they bring an enormous skill set, you know, to us, you know, along with the rest of the team and Jill and Gemma and the likes of.
Once this is online, I will put a link to your team, because I think I've had a look at it. You have got an incredible team. And that's something, obviously, you built up the people that you've looked for. So you want people that are passionate. But your story is absolutely amazing. And I think it's really important to say in this podcast that, you know, you being the leader, when people see a leader that does keep getting back up, no matter how many times they get knocked down, they see an extraordinary passion. And the whole point of this podcast is actually about what seemingly ordinary people that are actually quite extraordinary. And you're certainly one of those, Matt. You really are. It's incredible what you've been through.
Well, of course, it all went, I mean, that really accumulated to last year, because last year it all went horribly, horribly wrong. You know, I think I alluded to that in our last conversation.
Yeah.
Because I'd been having difficulties because my bowel was so badly affected. By, you know, and I don't mind admitting it. I mean, I've had a colostomy since 2015. That's a direct result. I've got a permanent colostomy now.
Well, you've had it less time than I've had mine, because I got mine at the end of 2013. So that's something we share in common.
Yeah. But it's okay, as you will know yourself, then that's quite a life changing. Experience, but you know, I just looked at
huge.
It, well, I'm here, and so you know, I think it's what it's you've just got to make the best of things, and you know, you think, well, okay, and I think it's made a lot easier by my wife, who just, you know, she just went, she has been a nurse for 30 odd years, she went, yeah, well, okay. And I think that's very, because I think, you know, a colostomy can be quite, it's quite difficult for yourself to get your head round it and your own body image. But I think if you've got that person in your life who says, you know, oh, no, don't worry about that, just crack on. You know, and but yes, last year I have been having some difficulties for about 18 months with some of the remaining bowel that I had. And, you know, it came to the point where it had to be resected. It had to be taken out, because there was a risk that if it was left, I might get other problems, you know, such as the big C problems with constant ulceration and bleeding and stuff like that, and inflammation. So they didn't want to leave it there. And of course, as you know, when you've got a colostomy and everything's defunctioned, you don't get any of the natural symptoms. So something nasty could grow and you wouldn't know it was growing. So they took the decision to do this. And it was quite a big op, but I was fit, you know. I'd been 2 years since the last heart attack. I was cycling 100 mile a week back today. You know, they were absolutely happy. And bless him, poor Mr. Gallagher, my surgeon that's been looking after me to 2010, he just went, the minute I went in with the laparoscope, everything that could go wrong went wrong. And, you know, so my 11-day stay turned into 3.5 months and two laparotomies. And but I'm back again. I bounced back. That did take the stuffing out of me. I was off work for about 6 months with that one, you know. But again,
I think you have every right to have the stuffing taken out of you with that one, because that's an incredible experience to go through. It's huge.
But I've got no real recollection. And I think that's probably the hardest thing for me, because if I think back to this time, because this time last year I was in intensive care. I was very, very ill at this time last year. I was about to go for a second major laparotomy because I bled. I was bleeding quite a lot into the abdomen, I think around about the 23rd of November. This was about 4 weeks after my first operation. And it's bizarre because if you ask me about that, I'd say, yeah, I was in hospital for about 10 days. That's all I can really remember. And I think the bizarre thing is people saying, oh, it's glad to see you, but you look so unwell in hospital. I went, sorry. He said, yeah, don't you remember me visiting you? And I had this whole stream of people and colleagues and friends, you know, that visited me in hospital. I've got no recollection of it whatsoever, you know, so it's
difficult. I actually have a memory. My bed when I was on the ward after I came out of intensive care was it kind of faced the nurses' station, and I actually have a memory. I remember having, well, you'll understand this, but having gone through, you know, you've got so many tubes in you, you don't know where they fit them all, you know, they're everywhere. And when there were two people that came to visit me, and I could see the nursing staff actually pointing at my bed and saying, she's there. And they were looking around saying, where? And they actually said to me, you were unrecognizable. In fact, one of my friends said, don't do that to me again. It was like coming to visit a corpse in the bed. So, you know, it's amazing what the body can go through and come back from, but it's not easy. And I just want to acknowledge that it really is not easy. And what you've been through is incredible, Matt. And to do what you're doing still, it's resilience plus, plus, plus.
Well, I think, to do what I do, you go back to what you're saying, you've got to have the team. You've got to have the right people around you, you know, and you're all working. I think that's where, you know, I go back, I think I'm so lucky, because with Jill McGill and Dr. Gemma Wilson, you know, I've got excellent two co-directors there that they really get it and they understand it. But you know what? Most, they actually care. They passionately care about what we're doing. Because, you know, I think Gemma, who we spoke about for, I mean, Gemma really specializes in older care. And she's doing a lot of the work in the War Widows community around social isolation and loneliness. Yeah. And, you know, she's taking a lot from what she learned in the work in the general population and really starting to work with the associations to develop that and really start to understand that.
It's fabulous stuff. And you know, I'd like to now kind of go on to talking about the Knock on the Door study, which I said to you before, I think it's been a very long time coming, and I'm so happy to see it just taking place. It's so important. So can you sort of talk a bit about that for the people that don't know about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll start. There's very little, if any, research done in the War Widows population. It's something I felt passionately about, I would say, since about 2008, when I had two quite significant clinical cases come through my practice in service. So even though I was the head of service, I was still a clinician. I still had to have, you know, so I looked after two bases in Portsmouth, two big tri-service bases, and I was their visiting mental health practitioner, psychotherapist, mental health nurse, where I would have my clinic and caseload in those areas. And, you know, and we get quite a mix through, but I had one really memorable case where it was a serving female and her husband had been killed in Afghanistan. And after a period of time, there was some concern that she wasn't really dealing very well with that. And this wasn't a newbie. She'd been in many, many years, very experienced, very capable, incredible servicewoman. You know, I knew of her before she came into my clinic. You know, it's got a long story short, that a lot of the difficulties with the bereavement that then went on to make her very ill with depression was a lot to do with how the notification and the management had been of her husband's death had been conducted, and how she'd been managed, looked after, cared for, things that were said to her, things that weren't, misinformation, you know, a whole catalogue of multiple, because we always talk about this. If you get one stressor, huge, you can deal with it. But if you get hit with multiple stressors and all these little bits that start to take an accumulative effect, and they just, on this lady, they had a catastrophic impact on her. And ultimately, it ended with, we ended her career. She ended up having to be medically discharged because she just couldn't continue. And probably, we got to the point where clinically it was felt it was better for her mental health probably if she didn't continue. What I can say now is that, she's gone on, she's moved on, she's better, she's rebuilt her life, and I'm still in touch with her, she's doing absolutely fine. But this is a person that went to the brink of suicide, as a direct result of that. Yeah. And I think I left that with a very lasting thing. And I remember when I'd started university and we started the hub, I'd saying to Jill, I said, if there's one piece of work I want to do, I think we really should look at the whole process of notification, how it's handled, who does it, how they're trained. I said, and Nibs was always sitting, and Jill would always go, you talked about that. I was thinking about 2 years ago. Well, I think it's really important for your listeners to understand it, because I think there was some confusion when we started the knock on the door, because you can never please everybody. And I think, so there was thing, there was a little bit, why are you doing that? There's far greater things you can do, and this you can do and that you can do. But of course, with any research, I don't think people sometimes don't appreciate actually how much research costs, to actually undertake research. Yeah.
I don't think they do, Matt. Yeah. And I think that's really important to get across today, is that research is always funded. That's the whole point of it. And it's expensive.
Yeah. Because ultimately, so if you look at my team, there's myself, Jill and Gemma, that are permanent members of staff at the university. And so with that comes other responsibilities that you have to do as part of the university. But then the likes of Michael and Anastasia and the rest of the team, they are, and Alison, they're all funded by research, and that's how research function. And at the end of their contracts, if I don't find more money to fund further research by competitive call or by whatever means, they lose their jobs and away they go. So research have, a lot of the universities have this great population of contracted research staff. That's how research takes place. So what's generally is, with the funder for the knock on the door, I'll openly say I'd been knocking on their door for a long time saying, something, we really need to do something with the widows population. We really need to think about, because this is what I'm interested in, And so I think sometimes when, as universities, you have those conversations with funders, sometimes they do listen and they put it in the bank. And they do it, and so it comes out as a competitive call. And now what that means is it's the funder that determines what the research is going to be to some degree. And of course, quite rightly with this one, I'd been talking all around the houses at MOD saying, I think we should do this. I think at the same time, I'd actually met Mary when I was Morland, when I was doing the chair of the War Widows Association, when I was at the Defence Select Committee. And she was giving evidence, I was giving evidence, we got talking, I listened to her evidence with great interest. And I'd actually had a conversation with her after and said, is there anything we can do? I said, this is exactly what the hub's for. We work with organisations, we work with populations. I said, you have to look at it, from small acorns to great oak trees grow. So what you haven't got to be is overambitious. What you've got to do is work to start a programme of research and to start. And so going back, so Mary was kind of pushing the funders. I was pushing the funders. And then lo and behold, somebody had a great idea that maybe something could push them out. They put out a call that just dropped perfectly. And it was quite a competitive call. I know a couple of my colleagues and friends at other universities went for it. But I think because we had such an understanding i.e. through my own practice, but also by partnering with the War Widows Association to do it. We were successful in the call. So going back to what we were talking about before, that we're actually, what we do is translational research. So that means any research project we do, there has to be a physical outcome. There's something at the end of it. There's a reason to do it. It's not just about writing a report and publishing a paper. We want it to be a stepping stone to the next stage. We want it to look at policy. We want it to make a change. So very much with the knock on the door, I think, well, this was my experience of you know, of one person where it was quite catastrophic. Then talking to Mary and a few of her colleagues, I said, well, yeah, you know, this was what happened to me. And then you start to talk about the triggers and some of the things that they most remember about that notification. And you're thinking, yeah, well, some of those aren't really good memories, are they? So I think what we, you know, what we said for the knock on the door was, what we need to do is we need to understand. I think that's got to be the first part. It's building a solid foundation from where to start if you were going to do long-term research. Because what we try and do at the Hub is we try and avoid doing one-off projects. What we want to do, if we're working with a community, we want to work with them into the future. So the idea of the knock on the door, was very much seen as the starting piece of work. Let's understand. Now, we know that there's different deaths around the Armed Forces Widows population, and it didn't capture everyone, but this key one was about the whole of the notification process and the impact that had on the family, how it was undertaken. Because really for us, and of course, what you don't do is you don't preempt your findings. So, you know, the whole idea is, let's do this piece of work and then let's see what it tells us. And then we can return to that. And then we can start to think, and by we mean the sector, because what we try and do is bring them in, you know, when we actually have the findings. And I think what we're going to aim to do with the War Widows, all being well, is have a virtual working group of those within the sector. So when we go forward, you know, it might be that comes out of that we work with MOD to look at the policy and the training of casualty notification officers, or we look at the whole policy of casualty notification going forward, and, you know, and work with it. The whole idea is this overall collaboration. But at the collaboration, you put the experts by experience, and they are the War Widows. And the process is called co-production. And the key thing about co-production is that actually those that are affected the most are the drivers of the outcomes, not the so-called experts. So experts like me become facilitators of the experts that I experienced, the widows. So we see me and my team were working with Mary and, you know, and the Army Widows and the Navy Widows and the RAF Widows, and to facilitate them taking their cause forward by providing them with really strong empirical evidence that can't be refuted. You know, if you've got one anecdotal tale here and one anecdotal tale there, it's very, very easy to dismiss.
Yeah. This,
as we see now with the enormous response we've had to the knock on the door survey, suddenly you've got this great body of evidence that's got hundreds of participants that have taken part in it. And if all they're all saying the same thing,
yeah,
it becomes very, very hard to ignore that.
And I think that's what
survey. Sorry.
That's what's so important, Matt. You know, is I love what I'm hearing here, because it's needed, whatever subject matter you're talking about, it is needed to have experts in that field. Of course it is. But human beings are experiential creatures. I'm always saying that. I always find myself saying that to people. So the fact that you're taking the experiences within this research of people is so vital. It's so, so vital because, as you say, if you've got one or two stories about things being like this or being like that, then they're kind of isolated, possibly, shall I say, isolated incidents. But when you've got a huge body of evidence, well, then you've got a pattern.
Well, here's the thing with that. So we know, as you know, with the survey, we there's not only the sort of the question, but we give a lot of text box for people to write in. Now, usually with those with a survey, people can't be bothered. They'll just go, yeah, no further comment. We have been overwhelmed with how people have shared, you know, so that in essence, with this survey, we've got the numerical, the number counting on one side, but we've actually got a whole new body of evidence, you know, textual evidence, story evidence that we're now starting to analyze on the other side that we kind of weren't expecting, because the usual rule of thumb with surveys are that, yeah, people don't write. And if they do, they'll write one sentence. We've got people that have been writing A4s. Now, this is so important, because what this gives us is it gives us that, as you say, the side of it to say, well, yeah, you've got 80%+ of your population of this survey saying this, you know, so this is not a one-off. This is a numerically common experience. And this is why, because look, they're explaining it here. They're actually telling you, you know, and that theme runs through it. But one of the things that's really, there's two things that have spun off from this. And, you know, we've been, I think in the initial parts, there was some felt concern that, you know, oh, how could you just send it out to everybody? You know, and I said, well, that was that wasn't just an off the spur of the moment idea. It was very carefully considered with the four associations, the War Widows Association, the Army, Navy, and the Air Force. Because actually, there's so much difference and variety within the Armed Forces Widows population and how the loss came about. You know, and Mary would have said, you know, with the War Widows, I said, well, there's absolutely no way we could select and pick. But also, we're dealing with a population of over 15,500. So you also couldn't go out and sort of ask them, well, what do you want to take? Because going back to the realities and pragmatism of research, well, you haven't got 2 or 3 years because you haven't got the funding to pay somebody while you go around. And, you know, so certain, you know, decisions in consultation with the experts by experience. And what we mean in that case was we were actually talking to the widows themselves. We had focus groups and we worked with the associations. What is the best way to deliver this survey? And of course, this is what they did. And some was concerned, well, you know, well, how could you send that to these Second World War widows? You must be traumatizing them. It couldn't have been further from the truth. Because actually now, in fact, we've just done two this week. We've had the grandchildren of, the sons of, and 90-plus-year-old ladies contacting us saying, would you like to hear my story?
That's incredible.
And so in addition to the survey and in addition to that data, we're now building up a whole separate piece of work where we're capturing the stories of Second World War widows.
That's incredible, Matt.
Yeah, but it's really important that is, because what we've identified is they are so different. They are so different, you know, and I thought this has actually led me to a bit of a dilemma, because we were talking about it this morning, because I think we say we did two interviews last week with two 90-odd-year-olds, and they are fantastic, you know. And then one of them said, well, I've got three of my friends that want to talk to you as well. So Jill is now going off organising three further interviews with the Second World War widows. And I said, you know, to present that data and how we write that up to, you know, we've got to bring it into historical context, because actually what's coming through with that population of widows is this real sense of stoicism. And I think that's very much to do with a generation that was at World War. And so actually for us at the university, we've gone sort of, you know, you can see me here, to a bit of head scratching and going, well, I think I'm going to have to go and talk to the history department. Because I think to truly do justice to this, to the stories that these ladies are telling us, we've got to bring it into historical context.
Yeah.
But that's so important because it actually starts to look at the whole aspect of casualty notification through time. You know, so these will be our oldest living memories now of casualty notifications amongst these ladies. And so it's going to be very important that we can see how the notification, the aftercare, the support has developed over that period, and then start to look at where it needs to go to and what needs to happen next. Because the other ones that came forward as a consequence that we weren't expecting were the children of.
Yeah.
So we've actually had, just very recently, we've had two or three children of Falklands War casualties who have come forward, and they said, well, actually, I was there with my mum and I was, you know, 10 years old or 12 years old. I remember it vividly. Would you like me to tell my story as a child from it? And of course, we're capturing those as well now as a spin-off from that.
And that's so important, because what a lot of people don't realise, I mean, the Falklands was my war. I mean, that was mm-hmm. where Gary got killed. So, you know, you've got a generation, as you're saying, with World War II widows who the nation was at war. And so it's a very, very different situation. Then in things like the Falklands War, you've got a war 8,000 miles away. And it was the first time, which we fought hard for, that repatriation was done. So, you know, we basically, you know, when you look through time, there are so many aspects, aren't there? But one thing that I do know, and I know this from going back to my days of being a counsellor in the hospital when I was dealing with patients, you know, that had been in that era. And I won't say what it was, obviously, but there was one particular lady who had the most horrific trauma during World War II. She actually told me in the ward, she was dying of cancer because all my patients were terminal, and she actually told me something that she'd never told another living soul in 40 years. And for me, in that moment, there is that sort of negative side to stoicism that people did tend to kind of carry on or try to in that way back in those times, because it was expected of you, wasn't it? The stoicism of that sort of era. So there's so many different aspects, but what I do is write in the Falklands blog. I talk to veterans, I talk to widows, but I also talk to children. And the devastating effect that it has on children is something, again, that needs looking at, in my opinion, completely separately, because they're in such a different situation, aren't they?
Yeah, and I think it's work undertaken by my colleague, another member of the Hub, a chap called Paul Watson. He works extensively with and researches children who are young carers for their parent who has PTSD, as combat related PTSD or service related PTSD. And I think when what Paul will tell you is to say, you know, if you're just taking it from one perspective, you get a one-dimensional view of the family. And actually, to truly understand, you need to be speaking to mum and dad, spouse, children, siblings, because then suddenly you'll get a three-dimensional picture, because one will see something different to what the other sees. And so it'll be a very different picture constantly. And how that will be. So it's quite important you do that. But there is always a lot of, especially now, you know, when we do work and we will speak to children 11 plus, you know, there's quite rightly, there's a lot of anxiety around that. But I think if you don't speak to the children, you end up missing an enormous amount, because what children see is usually far more than maybe many others.
I totally agree. I think it's so important. And I don't think people really understand, unless they've been in that situation, the actual potential for, you know, these war and conflict situations can absolutely blow a family apart. And it may be many years later that actually, you know, in the nature of the way that we do deal with trauma, or should I say don't deal with trauma, that's the whole point, you know, these things get sort of compartmentalized and they'll be triggered by something at whatever point.
And they do. I mean, we saw that. We did quite an extensive piece of work on limb loss and aging. So a lot of the work that has been done recently with the limb loss in Iraq and Afghanistan is very, very focused on the younger people. Because what we were interested in, and very much led by Gemma Wilson, Dr. Gemma Wilson, who I work with, because she specializes in gerontology. That's okay. But what happens when you start getting old?
Yeah.
And then you get all of the conditions that are associated with aging. And it's going back to what you were saying about actually stoicism is a good thing, but it's also quite damaging if you're not careful. And we actually saw it in that piece of work that stoicism became a blocker for asking for help, which then led to socialization.
Yeah, can I just interject there, actually, Matt, because it's an experience that I had when I was in hospital with a perforated bowel, that in actual fact, it's a perception thing as well, which I think is important with you looking at all sides of the story in terms of families, because I remember that the doctor that did my surgery, her interpretation of where I was at in that moment was that I was stoic. And in actual fact, PTSD had been triggered. I was frozen. I was traumatized and I couldn't speak. I wanted to scream, but I couldn't. So I think it's perception. And sometimes stoicism is actually, it's not even there. It's just a perception of somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It is, and I think it's picking what you're on about triggers as well, you see, because actually when we were doing the limbless study, that compartmentalization and, was very evident within, the participants of that study. And it's only when they started to tell their stories that that all becomes unlocked. And actually we're doing, we worked with 30 participants on that, and they spoke about afterwards about how cathartic it was, because it was the first time for a lot of them in their life that actually shared to that degree, because they'd never had any psychological input for their injury, for their loss.
Yeah.
And so for the first time in their life, and because a lot of the, when we do bits of work like this, we do use trained mental health professionals. We don't just go and, grab a first year PhD student and use them to go and gather some data. We're very, very careful with who we use to data gather, because actually they picked up very quickly that there was trauma present in these and those data collection sessions. And some of those were 2 hours plus over three interviews. There were 6 or 7 hours of data collection.
And that's the thing that's so important, because going back to my cancer patient many, many years ago, and this was in the early 90s, and I remember saying to you before, that was pioneering stuff. We had the first counselling service in a hospital in the whole of London. It was a real privilege to be a part of that. And that lady, when she said that she hadn't told another living soul what had happened to her in 40 years... It was my availability to sit down, draw the curtains around her bed, give her a safe space, and to give her the understanding that it didn't matter what she said to me, I was there to hear her, that made all the difference. It's recognizing that trauma's present and being able to allow the person a safe place and the permission to speak about it. So important.
It is.
So it looks like your research is just like, I know there is more than one project that you're working on at the moment. It's not just a knock on the door study. What else are you able to tell us at this point that in terms of research projects?
Oh, I mean, we've always got three or four quite significant project. So we've actually got another one in the War Widows population that's going to be developing. I mean, it's been going as strongly in the background, all the preparation work, but that is led by Dr. Gemma Wilson, and that's looking at social isolation in the population, especially amongst the older members of the population. But it looks across the whole piece. And then I know the War Widows, them themselves are doing a population around digital literacy and trying to reduce social isolation by actually helping members that aren't so IT savvy to actually get them online connected, can use the internet safely and bank safe and everything else. But also, I mean, we've just started quite a wide ranging piece of sort of scoping and work with Fighting With Pride, which is the only LGBT plus veterans charity in the sector. And, you know, that's very interesting work that we're looking at there. That's the impact of the ban. Because people, I think, sometimes forget, you know, before 2000, it was still illegal to be gay in the British Armed Forces.
Yeah.
And if you were discovered, you were arrested, criminally investigated, and then dishonorably discharged from the armed forces just because of your sexual orientation. And you would have your medals removed and you would lose all your privileges because it was a dishonorable discharge. And so with the with that charity where we're working, there's quite a, you know, there's quite a lot of work about the long-term psychological impact of that period over time. We're developing because we're working very closely with a lady called Jo Jukes, Jo has the community interest company, which is sort of a prelude hopefully to the charity of For the Fallen. That's working with those service families that lost their loved ones through suicide, be it in service or after service. So we're currently developing a bid, so it's quite a high value bid for an upcoming funding stream. We've been working with Jo, actually before that bid even arrived, we've been working with Jo because it was a piece of work we wanted to do anyway, looking at veteran suicide, but then moving towards, and what we've managed to do in that sort of the last 6 to 7 months is work with 14 families in focus groups, trying to understand that if, because I think the thing is that there's always a push that something needs to be done, and before you can do something, you've actually got to understand what is it that needs to be done, if that makes sense.
Oh, it makes total sense. No good.
Yeah, and the worst thing you could do is create quite a stereotypical, broad-based assumption on what needs to be done that's not based in evidence, and then you end up spending a lot of money doing something that's not going to work because it's missing the point altogether. So Jo, myself, and then another gentleman, a chap called Richard Gettings, who runs the Deparian Foundation. And Richard's a very interesting guy. He was actually a UK and Hong Kong policeman who suffered catastrophic PTSD whilst on service. But because he was a merchant seaman prior to that, he was picked up by combat stress. And as a direct result of that, he set up the Deparian Foundation, where it's a peer support network for veterans with PTSD. And working with it, so, you know, my thinking coming from that clinician's background, coming from that translational research background, where, okay, if we want to do something, what is it we do? You know, what would an intervention look like? How would we look to reduce suicide in that population? So working with the families, they, again, it's about this co-production. So it's taking us as the academics that become the facilitators, and then we work with these families to say, okay, we need all the information to look at this and understand each and every case, are there common themes? If we want to design some intervention, how do we go about it? What do you think? What would you be prepared to do? How would it work? And, you know, and so we've worked along this line, and we've developed quite a comprehensive bid now that, number one, we'll look at to understand. So we need to understand, is suicide in the veterans population and in service population, is it different to the general population? Are there different stresses? Are there different aspects? Are there different vulnerabilities? We don't know that yet, you know, and until you do that, you know, you can't, you haven't got that level of understanding. And I think we want to do this for two aspects, I think. And it's very much looking at what is becoming increasingly a preferred method of a safety model approach rather than a risk assessment. I think generally across health services across the world, there's a move away from this idea of risk assessment. I tick a box and then that tells me whether that person's going to do something or not. And actually, it's more about the relationship, not just with the clinician, but with the whole sector, about being more at ease asking somebody about their safety. Can you maintain your safety? Do you feel like you might harm yourself, or so it's kind of looking at a whole different approach to it. But of course, there's always the point in time where a clinician will deem that somebody can't maintain their own safety, and of course that needs an intervention. And of course, then it's about, well, what should that intervention look like? Because I think one of the biggest, from the focus groups, what we've learned is there still seems to be a big gap between somebody who you quite clearly know is not safe anymore to maintain their own safety. That means not to go and commit suicide, but they don't meet the requirements to be sectioned. And so they're left in this gap. And the worst thing we could do is go, right, okay, we know the fix for that, and off they go and design something, because actually you need that experience of the families and potentially those near miss veteran suicides to say, what would have worked for me would have been, because I would have engaged in that whilst I was feeling that way at that time. So you can imagine, prospectively, it's an enormous piece of work, and it's not a piece of work that's going to be done in 2 minutes. It's a piece of work that's probably going to take, I'd say, 10 years. To get
but it's a start. It's a start, and that's the thing.
Going back to what we said before, it's the same with the War Widows work. There's got to be an acorn. There's got to be a starting seed point where you do one thing, and then lots of other stuff spins off it.
And one thing I'd like to put into this conversation now is the thing that I spoke to you on, when we were talking on the phone the other day, is the changes. If I go back to when Gary was killed, it took 6 months for the funerals and the repatriation, and that obviously is a very unusual circumstance. And then, when I left where I was, it basically was going into Civvy Street, complete change of everything. But there was nothing then in terms of internet, or I had no idea that there was even a War Widows Association. Nobody said anything about any of those things. But there wasn't the ongoing support. And I remember saying to you that I actually paid, and I went to see a psychiatrist privately, and I was very open. I said, listen, I've got a problem. Whenever trauma strikes, I become anorexic and I need help. I really need help. I do not want to live the rest of my life like this. And his response was, you're very young and you're very pretty, and I think the best thing you can do is go and get married again. And I sat there in that chair, this is, 37 years ago, Gary's been dead 38 years, but I sat there in that chair looking at him thinking, I've just paid you to tell me that I should go and get married again when I'm trying to tell you I've got a problem. So he didn't hear me, obviously, wrote me a prescription for antidepressants, and off I went. Now, the knock-on effect of that conversation, and me being somebody that PTSD tends to put me in that place of freeze rather than fight or flight, that froze me in time, making me think that if I didn't go out there and find myself another partner and just get on with my life, there was something wrong with me because the psychiatrist said so. Now, that was prior to my counselling training. That was prior to my understanding that I've got today of, psychology and therapy. And I have to say that I've had incredible help in the last year since I had this, trauma in the hospital from the NHS, and how much things have changed. But I think it's really important to put that into this conversation from the perspective of things do take time, and we can't just demand change without, as you say, needing to know what change we need to implement and how we're going to do that.
And you point out that can be the worst, because I think that's where mistakes are made.
Yeah.
And I think it's, Because if you're not careful, you have unintended consequences if it's not thought through properly.
Well, there were huge consequences to that because, you know, it made me kind of put on this mask and try and hide all of the grief that was inside of me from the world. And then I indulged in coping mechanisms instead of dealing with the problem. And so people got a very weird perspective of who I was and how Gary's death affected me because they were judging the book by the cover. Mm-hmm. And coping mechanisms are exactly what they are, aren't they, Matt? But you know, they don't help you deal with the problem.
But I think the other thing that we must never do is we, you know, I think it's anything like this, because you quite rightly say over the last 37 years, there's been tremendous change. And thank God that change has been for the better. But you should never rest on your laurels. You should be always asking questions of that practice, of what's going on now. You know, it's because if you don't do that, it'll never move forward again. I mean, in Afghanistan, you know, on one side, we've seen through Afghanistan, we've seen, you know, absolutely incredible advancements in trauma care.
Yeah.
If you look at how the air ambulances operate now, and, you know, they carry live blood and all this all came out, you know, because there's lessons to be learned all the time. So I think you're quite right. Things advance, but you never say, oh, that's it. We've got it perfect now.
Yeah.
You know, you should always be evaluating what you're doing and thinking about what you're doing.
And that's what I love so much about the research and all the things we've talked about, because, you know, when we're looking at healthcare and we're looking at things like heart surgery and brain surgery and all the things that are physical, you know, there's always striving for advancement. So mental health, it's great to hear you saying that mental health should be exactly the same.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the classic one is why I kind of brought into the conversation was the whole idea around models of safety and co-production and peer-led models of safety within mental health. Because right up until probably a year or so ago, it was all risk assessment. Let's have a risk assessment tool. You know, let's validate the risk assessment tool. Let's try and mathematically count how risky you are at going and harming yourself. Mm. You know, and of course, really, you know, the constant questioning of that is something. It's about as good as licking your finger and sticking it in the air or flipping a coin. Actually, what we need to do, it needs to be an embodiment of how we run our services and how we interact with our patients, our clientele that we're dealing with. So every conversation you have with them is a very open conversation about safety.
Yeah. And I think that word is key in that sentence, open. Mm-hmm. The more open we can be about everything, the better information. You know, I love that survey, the knock on the door survey, which obviously I have completed and sent back. Of course I have. But I loved the way it was presented and the fact that there were those boxes. But there is that thing, you know, a bit like when you're applying for a job, you know, you can continue on another piece of paper if you wish to. Because for me, that meant that was my experience of looking at that was that box gave me quite a lot of space to write. But it also gave me the opportunity to not have to write more, but I could if I wanted to. And that, you know, that comes in that key word of choice then, doesn't it? You've got the choice to be as open as you wish
but
to
I
be.
I think what's really important about that, though, just so your listeners understand this, that wasn't from us.
Okay.
That we facilitated the production of the questionnaire, but the survey document came from the interview with the 14 war widows from which we analyze the data to create the questions. But then how the survey document was laid out and how it was developed was then from the next 20 war widows that worked with us to exactly how we should lay out the survey document and how we should ask those questions. So actually there's been, I think what we've got there, we've got about 34 war widows or armed forces widows involved in the production of that survey document, you know. And so we've done our researchy bit around the outside, sort of saying, yeah, we need to do that, and we need to measure that, and we need to validate that to make sure it measures what you want it to measure. But actually what you see in that survey document is a direct result of the input of those 34 people who had real input and control over what's developed. Because as you develop them, you take the surveys back and we go through with them as if they were a participant. And then, you know, they'll say, no, I don't like that. I want, you know, you should be asking this and it should be that way. And, you know, and this is hopefully where we get to something that's really meaningful. Because it's not coming from us as academics. It's actually coming from those with who are experts by experience. I know I keep using that, but they're experts by experience in what we're investigating.
But it's so important. And I'm glad, you know, to have kind of clarified that point, because it works. It works putting that experience into that, because when I saw that survey, there was nothing about it that felt, you know, it kind of covered the sort of things that I would have wanted to answer and questions I would have wanted to be asked. So, you know, that's great to hear, all of it.
And I think to reassure you, there's a few bits and bobs we did put in because we thought it would be really helpful as academics. But actually, when we actually ran it in the pilot, it became meaningless because it wasn't the bits that the War Widows themselves had put in. And actually, we ended up taking them back out again because, you know, we ended up with you know, how they're answering it. You know, we have something called floor ceiling effect. And if everybody says no,
yes,
then it's pointless asking the question because it's a pointless question. And of course, what you're always trying to do with a survey is make it as short and meaningful as possible.
Yeah. Well, it certainly was. And it's hard to even put into words how amazing I think this research is and how necessary it is, because, you know, for those of us who were widowed a long time ago prior to there being any social media and, you know, people didn't keep in touch in the same way, you know, our journeys were very difficult. So any steps forward for
just
widows.
To reassure you now, I've got three members. The response has been that good that I've got three members of my team who are busy working away, entering all that data into our statistical analysis packages, you know, which of course is the bit of research that's a bit hard and laborious. That's the hard graph, you know, making sure that they're transferred into our system so we can start to analyse. So we're looking to begin the analysis of that data in the new year. And we hope to have the preliminary report to the Armed Forces Covenant Fund Trust, the funders, by the spring, and then ready once that's all signed off. You know, we want to look, depending on the COVID, we want to look for a launch event to what the findings are. And then my ideas are that we share the report with all the associations so they can share it amongst the membership. And so we'll create a digital copy of that to do that. But I think what we'd like to do, you know, I'm speaking with Jill and Gemma about it then, is to potentially have a virtual event where we can use the Zoom, because of course it makes it so easy, where we can look at the findings and actually start again working with the populace. Okay, so what's the next steps then? Where do we go from here? What do you think we should do? What does this tell us? Who should we speak to? Who do we need to go to? In there, and I think that will be the next steps.
Matt, it's all incredibly exciting stuff, and it's been so valuable having this conversation today, and I thank you so much for being here and sharing so much with us. I'm sure it'll be helpful to a lot of people.
Great. No, it's an absolute pleasure, Jo. Thank you for asking me.
That concludes episode 6 of Alternate Realities. A huge thank you to Dr. Matt Kiernan for being with us today. He's truly an inspiration for the way that he deals with all that life has bestowed on him with regards to the struggles that he has had to face. His passion and his enthusiasm for research, as you heard, have got more than one project on the go at the moment. We need these projects. We need this research to enable us to move forward, because as Matt says, until we know exactly what it is that we need to actually implement change, we can't change policy and we can't move forward and help people and give them what they truly need. The last thing I actually needed in 1983 was a psychiatrist to tell me when I was suffering from PTSD and actually was begging for help. The last thing I needed to hear was that I was very young and very pretty and that I should go and get married again. It set up a pattern of behaviour, a coping mechanism that really didn't heal me. Yes, it meant that I could function in the world by using that coping mechanism. That's what they're for. That's what we use them for. But it doesn't promote longer term healing. And thankfully, those types of doctors are not around today. Mental health is moving forward, and we're finally learning more and more about how we can truly help those people who have suffered trauma. Episode 7 will be with you shortly. Thank you for listening today.